All right. It occurred to me getting ready for class that I had assigned chapter 13 but not chapter 14. Both of them have to do with reproduction in somewhat different ways. Some of you may want to read chapter 14. I think it's interesting stuff. You're not required to. I assume that was just because there weren't enough weeks in the semester to cover everything interesting. Chapter 13 is basically about things we can do with regard to reproduction, and chapter 14 is mostly about things we now know with regard to reproduction. So that in particular, I have a fairly long discussion, some of which we may end up on today, I don't know, of the implications of paternity testing. The fact that we now can tell quite confidently who the father of a child is. And also of genetic ambiguity, the fact that we know more than we once did about the fact that although almost everybody is unambiguously male or female, some people aren't in one of several different ways. So that's that, and also the issue of genetic testing, the fact that we are increasingly able to learn things about our own genetics, which may be relevant to how likely we are to have a heart attack or die of something or whatever. So I may well get to some of that by the end of today, but I just wanted to tell you, if you were curious, that's what's in the chapter, and you may find it interesting. I also wanted to mention, since this seems to be human reproduction for some odd reason is a subject that people find interesting, possibly because we are the product of many millions of years of evolution selecting for reproductive success, and therefore it's sort of the job we're designed for, and we're designed to pay attention to it, that there's a limit of four people commenting on any particular topic, but that limit applies only to whether it counts for the number of comments you have to make, not to whether you're allowed to do so. So at the moment, I've got three people commenting, and if two more people want to comment, the first one who claims it gets it, and the second one is welcome to send in comments, which will end up with everybody else's comments, but still has to do the normal number of things, on other things. I hope that isn't too confusing. All right, so as usual, I want to start with your comments. You read the chapter and presumably the Lee Silver book, and I'm interested in whether questions occurred to you, things you wanted to say about it or whatever, and when we run out of that, I've got various things worth talking about. So, comments? Questions? Nobody? Nothing grabbed you? Nothing struck you as legally interesting or socially interesting or morally interesting about the discussion? Yeah?
One thing, I don't know if you really touched on it too much, it's just like, what status would people have that would be like cloned or genetically developed?
Yes.
Science. What would their legal status
be? That's really two different questions, I think. One of them is, how do they count as people? And the obvious guess would be they're people. The other, much less clear one, is whose children are they? That is, we have rights and obligations with regard to our children. If somebody clones me, genetically speaking, the parents of that clone are my parents. That's what a genetic paternity test would show my father to be the parent of that one. Who counts as the parent? Do I count as the parent, having produced all the genetic material? Do the people who arranged the cloning to happen count as the parents, and so forth? Were you thinking of particular issues beyond that?
Basically, those issues, and also maybe aside from like the legal issues, would they be stigmatized in any way?
Are they at the moment? There are, after all, millions of clones alive. I had one in this class a few years back. Identical twins, of course. Identical twins are clones of each other. As far as I know, there's no particular stigma to being an identical twin. It's, you know, sometimes a little embarrassing, and people say which of you is which, and how did it, you know, it's, but it's no more embarrassing than lots of other things kids have to put up with grown-ups. So that it's hard to see why there would be stigma. There might be other issues in the sense you might think about, in what sense do you think of the clone as being the donor? Suppose there's, let me take in a sense a real case, not of a clone, but a case that starts out real. I had a close friend who I knew for many, many years who died of cancer a few years ago. He had an odd and interesting personality, and he wasn't very much like anybody else I'd known. He has a daughter who has some of that same personality, and I find it a little bit odd interacting with her. because this, in a certain sense, feels like my friend, except that she doesn't know me very well. I mean, I was a friend of her father's. She's not a close friend. She's a woman instead of a man. So it's sort of a weird situation. And you can imagine carrying that one step further. Suppose that my friend had donated some tissue and that cloning was a workable technology, and that a year from now I meet somebody who looks just like my friend, and if, as I suspect, quite a lot of personality is genetic, is a lot like, not exactly like my friend, but a lot like my friend. How am I going to react to that person? Right? Am I going to credit him with my friend's accomplishments? Am I going to feel the same obligations towards him that I would towards my friend? Things like that. So those are sort of interesting, I think, more social than legal questions. Legally, I mean, it seems to be very unlikely that a clone is going to be able to claim the possessions of the donor, even if the donor dies, because we've got inheritance rules, and, you know, children don't automatically, except in Louisiana to some extent, get stuff from their parents when they die. But I think it does. I think it is interesting. That is, of course, the only difference between the hypothetical future clone and the existing clones is the hypothetical future one is going to be a generation younger than the donor, right? Identical twins are the same age as each other, whereas you're going to have a 10-year-old who is the clone of a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old or something, and that could be interesting.
Do you know if anyone's ever actually been cloned?
As far as we know, there has been no artificial cloning of humans.
Okay.
There have been claims made, and it's conceivable some one of them is true. It's pretty clear that it's possible, because other large mammals have been cloned. I think it's pretty clear that it would be a bit risky at this point, because it's, you know, not a fully developed technology. So, but then, of course, we produce children in other ways that are risky all the time. It's nothing illegal about a woman of 45 having a baby, although the odds of birth defects are sizably higher than when she was 20. So I think the sort of strong antipathy to cloning is mostly irrational and emotional. That some of it comes from this bizarre idea that the clone is identical to the adult, rather than a newborn infant who's the identical twin of the adult, which is what a clone would be, and part of it the general idea that anything new is sort of scary and ugly and icky. And I don't really see any very strong reason why human cloning shouldn't be legal now, and much less reason if you assume that 10 years from now we can reliably clone other large mammals with no more problems than ordinary birth. Yep.
So, you know, along the lines of irrational feelings, in your book, the chapter discussed about how a set of parents can be able to selectively decide what kind of youth they want to be.
Yes.
So this kind of screening allows for them to, you know, say they didn't like it or whatever characteristics they have.
Well, if you're talking about selecting a sperm and an egg, they can only do it within the parameters of what they've got.
I'm talking about like maybe being able to screen for, like not all sperm and not all eggs are identical, right?
That's right. So you could, if the technology was good enough, select among the genes that you have which half you want to contribute, and among the genes your wife has which half you want to contribute. But I undoubtedly I have no tall genes at all. We've wiped them out of the gene pool long ago. So I probably actually I don't know, my son, I like to claim that my younger son is tall, but he's probably 5'6" or so, something. 5'7" maybe, unreasonably tall anyway.
But so, you know, you could by intervening and screening out
yes.
Genes, you can in effect could have potential offspring that are, you know, better off. But say later is found out and it may well be if you look at this population better. But say it turns out there was something that was screened out that turns out later on would have been beneficial to the child. And even though the chances of that would be very low, I feel like people will react. The moral problem that a lot of people have would they would highlight the small
The obvious response is you're always screening out half of them anyway, so how can it be better to do it at random than to do something at least somewhat better than random?
But the knee-jerk reaction will be that, oh, well, if you didn't do anything,
it's not my fault.
Yeah,
it's possible. I could imagine that.
Yeah, I was reading from that book by Lee Silver.
Yep.
Who is talking about you know, mutations in general, sometimes you think of mutations as a bad thing, but in the end, sometimes it ends up actually benefiting evolution.
Yep.
You have to wonder, to some extent, if we're visibly cutting out things that we think are defects, they actually might have some positive.
But remember that if the selection is being done by the parents, different parents will have different concerns and different preferences. So therefore, even if I might have eliminated a particular mutation which I thought was harmful but I was wrong, it's quite unlikely that everybody will have, unless that mutation is a brand new one and I'm the only one who carries it, which I guess is possible. But also, of course, evolution is a pretty slow process, and I think most of us are not looking far enough ahead to be concerned with whether 50,000 years from now the human race has got some useful extra characteristics.
Yeah, I was thinking something along the lines of like having a disease, but perhaps the genetic testing shows early on that, okay, your child is carrying the gene for this disease, but perhaps when it's formed, you figure out that they're a carrier, and they're not exactly there.
But that you would... No, I think you're one step closer to the present than he was, I think.
Okay.
I think you're imagining the case where you produce a fertilized egg.
Mm-hmm.
And let me for a moment run through, I'll come back to you in a minute, but run through, if we think about one of the central issues here is ways in which parents can control what kind of children they have.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine a set of technologies starting with the oldest and lowest tech and going up to the sort of futurist and highest tech. And the oldest technology for this one, which has been going on for thousands of years, is selective infanticide. All right, that's the Greek approach, that you expose a child who looks like a weakling, or a daughter if you want a son, or things of that sort. And that, you know, it works. It's got the virtue that you can see how the kid turned out, except you're only seeing it as an infant, so you don't know what it's going to turn out like as an adult. The next one is selective abortion. And that's probably, at this point, I think, the most important one now going on. So what selective abortion is doing is saying, woman gets pregnant, amniocentesis can be used to learn what the genetics of the fetus are, and basically, at the moment, probably the only thing that happens in a country like the U.S. is if the amnio shows that the fetus has a really serious defect, such as Down syndrome, the parents may decide to abort. But in countries where there's a very strong preference between gender, it can also be, if you're Chinese and you're only allowed to have one child and you are desperately want to have a son, that if it turns out that you're carrying a daughter, you abort that and try again. So that's sort of the next tech. That's a technology currently more or less off the shelf, as it were, given that amniocentesis is available and abortions have existed for a long time. The next one, which I think Lee Silver discusses, is, I think, doable at this point and is sort of the improved version of that. And that's the one where you do it in vitro, you produce a bunch of fertilized ova, you wait till they get to the 8-cell level, which apparently is the point at which you can extract one cell from the fetus without injuring it. You extract one cell and analyze it, and then you pick of the one fertilized ova which one you want to implant. And presumably you freeze or destroy the others. So that's really like the abortion system, but it's a much more specific way of doing it because, A, you have less of the moral problem because an 8-cell pre-embryo doesn't feel as much like a person as a fetus that's got a beating heart does, and you get to select from a larger number of alternatives instead of just having one and then do it or don't do it, go or no go. You get to have some bunch of them and choose the preferred one. So that at this point I think is doable, if I understand correctly, although I don't think it's yet very common. Then there's the version that I credit to Robert Heinlein in one of his early and less good novels, which is the one where you can separately select egg and sperm. And that's, if you think about it, an enormously more powerful approach, because instead of saying you need one fertilized ovum for each try, you can in effect say, all right, here are 1,000 sperm, here are 10 or 15 eggs. That gives us a total of 10,000 alternative children we could have. Pick the best out of 10,000. That's really a very, very high-powered tool if you want to think of controlling it. And it occurs to me that there is, in fact, a very primitive version of that that already exists. And that is that there are techniques for trying to separate out sperm according to whether they're carrying an X or a Y chromosome. That the X chromosome is apparently larger than the Y chromosome. And the result is there apparently are techniques, I think using centrifuging, though I'm not sure, where they can separate sperm in such a way that one group is mostly X and one group Y. You then either IVF or artificial inseminate with the separated sperm, and you now have a woman who's got like an 85% chance of conceiving a boy or an 85% chance of conceiving a girl. The odds aren't the same, it turns out, whatever the numbers are. So that really is Heinlein's method, in that you're separately choosing sperm, although you're not separately choosing eggs. But it's sort of the very crudest version of Heinlein's method. So all of those are possible ways of doing it, although possible. Heinlein's version we can't do yet. We don't have the technology by which you could determine what the genes are of a single sperm or egg without damaging the sperm or egg. But he, as I mentioned in the book, sketches an ingenious way in which, in principle, you could do it, and I assume at some point in your lifetime, it'll be doable, is my guess. So then there's one more method I should mention, which isn't genetic at all, but which sort of comes out of something which I think I discussed in this chapter, it might be the other chapter, and that's the prenatal environment, that there is pretty good evidence that one of the things affecting an infant is the hormone mix in the womb he was incubated in. And so you can imagine people modifying that. In particular, I think I discussed it in this chapter, there's evidence that certain characteristics we associate with masculine and feminine, in fact, vary within masculine and within feminine as well as across, and have some predictable results. In particular, it looks as though it is true both that men are relatively better at math and women relatively better at verbal skills, and that men incubated in a womb whose hormone balance is in the direction of what the hormone balance of a womb with a female fetus in it are in that respect more like women, and women the other way more like men. So that would suggest that if you wanted, suppose you really want to have a mathematician as a kid, and you could say, well, not only will I select for a boy because I think boys are more likely to be mathematicians than girls, but we're going to artificially change the hormone balance in the womb to get a very masculine boy, and maybe if it works, I don't think we know enough to be confident that'll produce a great mathematician, but at least it has some tendency, it'll, you know, raise the chances from 1 in a million to 1 in 100,000 or something of producing a great mathematician. So that's, I don't think I go into much detail in that, although I think I mentioned the evidence in the, I think it's in the chapter you read. But so that's one other way. So those are all ways we could try to, that parents could try to modify their children. Now to get back to you, I think you were asking about the specific case where you're doing it by selective abortion, so that was...
I actually wasn't saying by selective abortion. I was thinking more of the embryo.
So that's a sort of a selective abortion, but it's a fancy selective abortion.
I'm just talking about the concept of when you make the decision to eliminate a certain trait.
But at that point, you know whether he's a carrier or not, because the question is, does the fetus have one or two of the relevant genes?
Yeah, I don't quite know the concept of some people that they carry the gene for disease but do not display. So isn't this how we eventually make medicines that are able to defeat by finding people that are carriers but don't exhibit?
You may be right. I was thinking of genetic defects, not of contagious diseases, where I think you're, and I am for the genetic defects, I think the usual distinction, maybe there may be cases that's what you're describing as well, there probably are, that the usual distinction is for a recessive gene, that somebody who carries one copy is a carrier, somebody with two copies actually exhibits the characteristic. And so the disadvantage of one copy is only that if you then mate with somebody who has a copy, your children have one chance in four of getting both, and thus losing out on that gamble. But it won't affect you. But I think there are cases where one copy has one effect and two copies has a different effect. But you would know, if you did genetic analysis, you would at least know whether the person had one or two copies of the gene. But I agree, you might not necessarily know the consequences. I've had my genes analyzed, not a full genotyping, which was still expensive, but there's this mail order 23andMe place where you send them a swab from your cheek and they analyze for those things that they know about and then send you, I just got updated information today from which I discovered various things that I was sort of either more or less likely than random to suffer from. And at this point, that's not at the level of saying you will have it. It's at the level of saying this particular gene variant is associated with X. If you have the gene variant, you have a somewhat higher than average chance of problem X. If you don't have it, you have a somewhat lower than average. That's sort of the level of current knowledge. You could certainly imagine the case, given how imperfect knowledge is now, where using that information we say, well, look, this gene variant gives you a higher than average chance of coming down with leukemia. I think leukemia, a version of leukemia, is one of the things I just got information on that I think I do not have a higher than average chance of, likely, fortunately. And we might not know that that gene variant also had some large good effect that hadn't been discovered yet. And in that case, you'd certainly be making a mistake. But then if you choose at random, you also could be eliminating that one. So it seems to me it's hard to argue rationally that choosing is worse than not choosing, even though in any case where you're choosing, you might make the wrong choice. Now, you may be right that you might argue emotionally that choosing, I'm responsible for the mistake. And, I mean, in some ways, I sort of feel that way. I think I would be very uncomfortable being a surgeon, even if I had the ability, or any physician dealing with life-threatening things. Because if you're a surgeon, almost certainly you sometimes make the wrong choice. And even if I said to myself, look, if I weren't a surgeon, these five people would have died. The result of my being a surgeon is those five lived, but that one died, because that was the one where I made the mistake. I don't know how easy it would be to live with the knowledge that somebody was dead because of my mistake. And you could see similar, I mean, that seems really his point with regard to children. Other point, people on? Yeah.
I found the discussion on class genes pretty interesting, where you're going to have this separation,
yes,
potentially. And then you felt that since human mating is not strictly intra-class, you may not need to be concerned about it, or the cause.
It's not strictly intra-class.
Intra. I found the analogy with the television set a little strange. Like, even if it does, I think that maybe if there is that difference in classes, that gap may be insurmountable, or at least mountable at some point, right?
Why? That is only if we keep inventing new and more important things that keep being expensive. In that case, you could have a permanent effect. But if what happens is that there's a period of 20 years during which the rich can get the good genes and the poor can't, and thereafter they're aspirin, then you have a brief period in which the children of the rich have some advantage over the children of the poor, which they have anyway, but some additional advantage, and then you don't. No. If anything, it seems to me, I don't know if I've discussed this with Lee Silver, if he does, that it goes the other way around. That is to say, there are currently sizable genetic differences among people. My guess is that those differences correlate with income as well as with other things. That my guess is that if you knew enough, it would turn out that on average, the rich people have genes that both rich and poor would prefer to poor people, because one of the reasons that you're rich is that you had, there are other reasons, but one of them is that you or your ancestors have the genes that made you, you know, a very successful X, Y, or Z that made you lots of money. So if that's right, if you have genetic engineering, now everybody can have the good genes, right? So that if it really turns out that, so that it, first it, you would expect it to reduce, forget about present inequality. You just say, imagine all of whom started out at the same social level. Some of them, by pure luck, have the genes that make them smart and healthy and beautiful and so forth, and some of them don't. That variation is going to be reduced when you know more about genetics. Because now we can say, all right, we know that if you have variant X, you're going to be dumb. So we'll make sure we don't give our kid variant X. And we know that if you have variant Y, you're going to be very healthy. So with genetic engineering, everybody gets variant Y. So that level of inequality gets reduced. The inequality between current rich and poor, it seems we can go either way. That there's Lee Silver's argument, which says the rich are going to have more access to the technology, and then there's the counter argument, which says, yes, but the technology in some sense lets the poor have what the rich already have, to the extent that the rich are partly rich because they indeed have the genes that make them smart.
Also, the question is this really similar to the television set, which likely just was covered by patent rather than something like this, which easily could be protected by trade secret? So
how in the
reason.
World can you protect something by trade secret
you're
when a million people are carrying identical copies of it?
But what I mean is the process of how you are manipulating these genes, you could cover through trade secret, right?
Very, very hard. That is, I would have thought, I don't know, so we aren't doing it yet, but I would have thought that the big innovation, if you're talking about real genetic engineering, is creating the gene. And once the gene is created, you know, all you got to do is find one person who's carrying it, you got it.
So I guess that's very hard. It's the process that they're doing. Also, I was just, in the other way, there's almost just this kind of curiosity about how it might affect casual sex. Where what you were saying is, put in economic terms, sperm is a free good.
So that's right.
Almost, just go
that, as I discussed, I think in the other chapter, humans and many species of birds share the same mating pattern. We don't share it with many other mammals. And that's monogamy tempered by adultery. And there's a good deal of evidence in the case of birds, because you can much more easily do testing on birds than on people, because you don't need their permission. And it's reasonably clear that there are a bunch of bird species in which the male and female mate sometimes for life, but in which a significant fraction of the chicks are not, in fact, sired by the male. And male birds may engage in various attempts to monitor their mates, to make sure they're not having sex with other male birds, and female birds in various ways evade the monitoring. And a plausible evolutionary explanation of what's going on is that the optimal female strategy is to find the best mate you can who's willing to help you raise your children or your chicks, and then, given the opportunity, be unfaithful to him with a male who will produce better offspring, in your opinion. That's at least a plausible interpretation of what's going on with the birds, and I think arguably with human beings as well. And there's a lot of disagreement on the data on humans, which isn't surprising because it's obviously a heavily loaded subject, so that there's one source for a supposed study in England which suggests rates of misattributed paternity of something like 20%. And then there are several, I would say, much better sources in the sense of based on much more detailed data, one from Iceland or one from Switzerland, which suggests about 1%. But certainly, obviously, misattributed paternity does sometimes happen. And one of the points I make in the next chapter is that it's going to stop happening now because we got paternity testing. But at the moment, think about current technology. Do you really doubt that there are women who, having concluded that they're not going to be able to get a husband they want to be married to but want a child, deliberately select the father of that child?
I'm sorry. So a woman that is married...
Is not married. Take the case which I happen to know exists, because I know one, of a woman who is not married, who is willing to be a single mother, who therefore selects among the men she knows one who she thinks would produce very high quality children, has sex with him, may or may not tell him what's going on, and then bears that child. I know a woman who I don't even know if it was artificial insemination or not, but I know a woman who deliberately had a child, or she told me so, by a man she was not married to, had no intention of being married to, but who she thought would produce very high quality child, so to speak. So that would be one version. And that version in a modern society where a sizable fraction of women have children without being married seems to me quite likely. And of course with sperm banks and artificial insemination, you aren't limited to the men you actually know and can get to sleep with you. It could be a man you had never met who was no longer alive, but who was a great concert pianist and you really want your children to be musicians. You can think of lots of examples along those lines. But the general point is only that one low-tech mechanism, as it were, by which desirable genes can spread across classes is simply that.
But what if the world where this genetic engineering or biotechnology is just common, and so that isn't the way that we're reproducing, so you're almost limiting that natural impulse? Is that something that
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
So that natural impulse to make mate, I guess, you know, to propagate the species isn't the same when you have this type of technology as if we will almost breed that
there,
out of
us. There, for a moment, I'm not sure if I understand. Let me go back a bit and come back one, because in addition to the methods we've described, the set of things I ran through initially were all ways in which a couple could have their own child, but select among the children they could have. The next level of that, as it were, is a way in which a child has, in which they have at least partly somebody else's child, and of course that's also an old technology. We call it adoption. And it's probably more common now than it has been in the past. I'm not quite sure why, but it seems to be. But you can imagine among the modern versions, one of them is artificial insemination. You could imagine. And nowadays, I think you only get those. In fact, all of them, I think, you now get pretty much only for couples who cannot produce children by the normal method. So you have a couple where the couple are both infertile, or two women or two men who are a couple, and they adopt. And that's, you know, quite fairly common procedure, not always permitted, but where it is permitted, it's fairly common. I think especially for two women. Yep.
I think what you're getting at is with artificial insemination, if we're doing kind of everything in a petri dish, then we're taking away that.
That's not artificial insemination, that's IVF.
Well, either way, yep. It's not two people getting together and putting organs.
But they can still do that.
Yeah, they can still do that. He's saying that if we're doing it in a petri dish or with a turkey baster or whatever,
yeah,
it's not the same as, you know, making eyes at somebody across
but,
the body.
But how different would it be for a moment? Imagine, let me take the most conservative version, as it were. Imagine that the couple gets married, the couple have sex with contraception. At some point they decide they want a child. The woman donates 10 eggs, the male donates a bunch of sperm, the appropriate technologists go through and select out one sperm and one egg after consulting with the couple on what they want. They fertilize that egg with that sperm, they implant it in the woman, and the woman has a baby. Is that significantly different, emotionally speaking, from the current method?
Well, what I was going to say in response to his is that I don't think it's that different from the traditional method, because even if you're, say, going to a sperm bank, it's still like shopping. Whether you're looking at the human, you're still reading their profile, looking to see what their SAT scores are. Maybe there's a picture of them. So you're still making that kind of evolutionary.
Except that at this point, presumably when you're choosing a mate in the ordinary system, those may be some of the characteristics that you're looking at. You're also looking at, is this person I'd be happy living with? You're also looking at, is this person who turns me on? There are going to be a whole bunch of things additional to, is this a person who would produce wonderful babies with me? And in the sperm bank case, that's the only one. But all I was saying is, it seems to me I think it's useful in many of these things to start with the sort of closest to what we're doing and then steadily move forward and see where the problems arise. So I want to start with the case where you have a couple who get married in a perfectly ordinary fashion, have sex with contraception, which is what most couples do much of the time, but at some point produce their own offspring using IVF and implantation so that among the offspring they could have, they get something closer to what they want. Is that going to be very much different for people?
So I think one of the key differences as you move into the future will be that the contraception, the birth control that they use will probably be much more advanced and probably on both sides. So where you have this evening out of genes from that class that is wealthy and has more access to technology or not, it's less likely the casual sex will result in another child. So I think that gap may still widen considering that.
Except consider that sperm is a free good. So if a woman who is not in your gene-rich class wants to bear a child with good genes, somewhere there is going to be an upper-class sperm donor who's happy to donate it, whether via sex or whether via sperm bank. I mean, it's somewhat harder for eggs. Eggs are not a free good, although they're still a cheap good compared to babies, so to speak. That is, I gather that the process for extracting eggs is something of a pain, from what I've been told. Although, again, that may be less true in the future as we know more about doing it. But the real issue here is that people want to have their own children. I mean, that's where it seems to me there's a really interesting split, as it were, as you change your technology. So the initial version I described solves that problem. You're still having your own children. The currently common versions, namely adoption and sperm bank, are, I think, almost exclusively used by people who can't have their own child. And so you say, well, all right, we're going to produce a baby. It's going to be our baby because we were going to raise it. It's not going to be my baby, but then I'm not capable of siring a baby. That would be the hypothetical case. And so it's better than the alternatives. It gets interesting when you imagine cases where people will choose to have babies, or might choose to have babies, who are not their own, but in some sense are more desirable. So then you could imagine the case where a couple deliberately shopped for both sperm and egg, maybe implanted in the woman's body, or maybe hire a host mother, and then produce a child. And at that point, it seems to me it starts getting interesting, in a sense, to ask the question of how many of our emotional feelings are hardwired. This is the same issue. One of the things I discuss in the next chapter is that with paternity testing, you have the possibility for a bunch of mating patterns other than the standard one. All right, the standard one is monogamy. For human beings, is monogamous pairing. It's not exclusively, but that's been the most common. You could imagine easily enough, once you have, arguably the reason that's the standard one is that men want to know what baby is theirs. Women know when they see it coming out of their body, but men don't. That's no longer a problem because of paternity testing. So you could imagine, let us say, a group marriage of several men and several women, where they all share sex, but when a child is born, it is the child of a known man and a known woman. And how well that works depends largely on whether sexual jealousy is hardwired or not. It might be that sexual jealousy is not hardwired, that what's hardwired is the desire to know who your children are, and that it's just a means, or it might be that it isn't. I don't know. The people who push the idea of polyamory claim that their subjective experience is that it isn't, that they are comfortable having such mating arrangements. That's a very small minority, and they may represent the far tail of a distribution that most people don't fit. And you could imagine other systems as well. So one of the questions I'm discussing in the next chapter is, I think of paternity testing as the stealth reproduction technology. Because unlike cloning, it didn't get sort of a high profile, this is scary, etc. And yet it's got enormous potential to change human behavior, both because it makes possible mating patterns which don't depend on a man having exclusive sexual access to a woman, as almost all historical mating patterns did. And as a secondary effect, more immediate but less important, it means that you actually know who the father is, and that sets up a conflict between the mother, the putative but non-biological father who thought he was the biological father, and the state welfare agencies on who's going to pay for the kid. And that's a real issue at present. I find it a less interesting issue than some of the others, but it's there. Because on the one hand, it seems monstrously unjust that a man who's been swindled once by having the woman he thought was his exclusive mate have sex with somebody else, then has to pay for the result. On the other hand, someone's got to pay for that baby. And especially if the man thought it was his baby for the first year, and therefore the baby's used to thinking of this as daddy, there's sort of an argument for that. So that's a real issue at present, and as I find it somewhat less interesting than the more futuristic ones. But anyway, now go back to what you were saying.
I'm sorry.
All right, so all I'm saying is you can imagine a society where you can imagine a bunch of different things with the technology that we already have. Before we get into genetic engineering, you can imagine women simply getting sperm from a sperm bank. You can imagine a couple who could produce their own children, either getting sperm or getting sperm and egg, and then having the woman incubate the baby. You can imagine, on the other direction, a couple who are both fertile, but where the woman doesn't want to go through the unpleasantness of pregnancy, who produce a fertilized ovum of their own and rent a womb. This is not a hypothetical case. It's the way my granddaughter was produced, as it happens. Because my grandson was born very premature, would not have survived if he'd been born 15 years earlier. is fine now because we've gotten very good at dealing with preemies, and his parents decided that it was more prudent to have their second child in India using a rented womb but their own genetic material. And it worked. Cute little girl. So that's a possibility. But you could also imagine doing it purely because, you know, the mother is a high-end lawyer and she doesn't want to take out, you know, 9 months or however much of the time it would be to have a baby when she can just hire someone else to produce the baby. So one question is that objectionable? Does that bother people? And then you can get further versions. So far, I'm only doing things within the technology we now have. You then get the possibility of cloning. Notice that cloning has a real advantage over the methods I've described. Because in the case where you're buying a sperm and buying eggs, you know what the donors were like. You don't know what the combination is going to be like. You don't know which genes are going to go. You could just have the bad luck that the one gene that made that brilliant penis or brilliant penis is not in these particular sperm that you used. But cloning, we can do much better than that. Because cloning, you've got all the genes. You say, all right, here is the person who had exactly the characteristics I want in my baby. Zip. And we will now produce a baby who genetically, at least, is that person. So that's one step further. But it's a step further in the same pattern, as it were. And so then you get the question of, does it bother you morally? Will it bother people emotionally? Be interesting to know. I don't know enough cases of adoptions. The only case of adoption I actually knew moderately well, because the woman, that's the child in question, only as an adult, was a housemate of ours for years and was a close friend of my wife's. And that was a case where she was adopted by a couple who I assume were infertile, I don't know, who were what I would describe as successful blue-collar types. That is, they were not poor, but my guess is neither went to college. The daughter was and is a semi-professional lutenist. She met my wife at Oberlin, where they both went to school, a highly intelligent, musically very talented person. My impression, the one time I visited the parents, they had pictures up on the wall of, you know, news stories and things, and it was this sort of feeling of the ducks who raised a swan. They thought it was so wonderful that they'd had this really talented daughter. And obviously she was very close to the parents. Now, I don't know if that's a typical case. If it is, then that would suggest that the fully bought genetic material would really be an attractive option to many people. But maybe it isn't. Maybe the feeling, no, I want this to be me again, is going to dominate. I don't know. Other? You want to continue? Yes? No? Yep. No. Did you want to say more?
No,
you were raising the issues. No, they're interesting issues.
I think the one, and I don't want to beat a dead horse,
yep.
But I'm, okay, so when you said that you didn't think it could be covered by trade secret, like this type of thing.
I think it'd be very hard to keep it a trade secret.
Well, but I think that considering just how many genes you or I
yes.
have, that, and that the product of that would be releasing would be something like you or me, right?
I'm not sure which technology you're considering. One thing.
No, I think right now I'm looking at it as a big technological
flaw. Let me describe what are the things that are available. One of them that's going on right now is figuring out what genes have what effect. So that's why I just got an email from 23andMe saying we've discovered 5 new things about your genes, and I go to their webpage and they say it turns out we now know the genetic variant such and such. Increases or decreases your chance of certain things happening. It turns out, if they are right, that eating unsaturated fat instead of saturated fat will not result in my being thinner. Might result in my having less cholesterol. That's a separate issue. But according to them, there is now evidence that for people of European ancestry, they tend to separate it that way because they can't count on the same things applying for other groups. So they're reporting on scientific experiments on what people have done with various particular population groups. And for people of European ancestry, if you have 2 of a particular genetic variant, if I've got it right, you are more likely to be fat if you eat saturated fat than unsaturated fat. And I forget the situation with 1, but if you have none of that variant, there is no such effect. I have none of that variant. So that's the level of what they're now doing. Basically, they're doing studies on bunches of people where they know something about their genetics and something about how they turned out and getting results. And they can say, the funniest one, actually, funny in an odd way, was when my original evaluation, 23andMe, told me that I had an above average chance of having a meningioma, which is a benign tumor, kind of skull, a brain tumor, except that it's outside the brain but inside the skull. And this would have been very interesting information if I hadn't had a meningioma removed from me a few months prior to receiving this information from them. I had surgery about 5 months ago, went fine, and there was indeed a benign. As you may know, in normal speech, benign means it's good for you. In medical speech, it means it could be worse. So benign tumor is a non-cancerous tumor, which was the good news, basically. So they opened up my skull and took out a lump of stuff and closed it up again, and I have a permanent scar. It was not very functional for a month or so, but other than that, it's fine. But in fact, 23andMe called it. They just called it a little bit after I found out about it. But the information of that sort, of saying we now know that this gene variant makes this more likely. And it's true for a very small number of characteristics, obviously. But that's going to steadily increase. And they clearly aren't treating it as a trade secret. The way it's currently being generated would be very hard to treat it as a trade secret because 23andMe didn't generate that information. They just read medical reports. But you could imagine, I don't think it's very likely, somebody who puts a whole lot of money into doing a whole lot of such studies and keeping the results secret. And that could be a trade secret.
So I think what I envisioned was more gene manipulation.
Right.
Rather than just the simple combination of
existing. So you're imagining the case where we say, all right, we've figured out enough about how genes work so we can design our own.
And now, how are you going to copy what somebody does there? Because you may know what an unhealthy gene is like.
But you can copy the gene really easily. All you need to do is find their first customer.
Right.
You can't.
But the whole point is that this customer had an unhealthy gene or potentially had that, and now you've constructed a completely healthy genome.
I'm sorry, you're talking about a gene or a genome?
So whatever customer you had that came to you said, I want to produce a genetically perfect shot. So you know...
That's just not an option. Genetically perfect is even confusing it. What you're talking about is a child who in some ways is improved. But again, I'm not sure which technology you're talking about. Are you talking about a technology where we combine existing genes, possibly from multiple people, or are you talking about one where we create a new gene?
If you're creating a new gene or correcting issues with...
So let us suppose that we understand enough about how genes work so that we can design a gene which will make people age more slowly. That would be a biggie. All right? So we create a new gene that never existed in nature, which if you had it would result in you aging more slowly, and we find some way of splicing that into the genotype of an existing egg or sperm, and for our customer we do that, and the customer now produces an offspring who has that new gene. At this point, once we've done it for a few offspring, all a competitor has to do is to find one of those offspring, get one cell from him, and if we've reached the point where we can do this sort of thing, we've also reached the point where just analyzing the existing genes is going to be trivial. You do it, you know, for 10 cents. So they analyze and say, aha, here's one that we didn't know about. That must be it. Zip, copy that, and we're in business too. So you might be able to patent it, but I don't see how you're going to be able to keep that a trade secret. Now, you might keep a trade secret the information that let you design it. So you might say, well, all right, it's going to be a while before people catch on to what we're doing. We'll make money by giving it for the 5 years for which nobody else really knows about this. And then we're going to come up with a new design gene that does something else and so forth. So that's not impossible. But I think really keeping the gene itself secret really doesn't look to me like a doable project.
The gene itself secret or the process, and I think you're absolutely correct where you're creating a new one that it would like the gene itself would be patentable and then they just copy it.
Well, notice that patenting it raises a whole bunch of fun legal issues.
Yeah.
Because, of course, if something is patented, you don't have the right to make copies of it. Well, it's sort of hard to live without making copies of your own cells. Right? Well, that's not too hard because there was an implied license. When we produced this engineered gene for your baby, there was the implied license your baby was permitted to live, and therefore that your baby could itself make copies of its own cells. Now the baby grows up, and you might say, but does it have permission to make another copy? But given the length of patent, that's probably not an issue, because by that time the patent's expired. That's right. That's right. Really, really young sex. You're going to be violating the patent on your own cells, depending on what license they gave you, because you're going to be producing an offspring who may have this patented gene in its cells, and you never had a license to do that. Right? That would be an entertaining case. But anyway.
Yeah. I think considering how they may be covered, though, by that intellectual property law, whatever they
yep.
use, though, really is interesting when considering that class.
Yes. Yes. Well, but it's interesting more generally as to how it's going to fit into. I mean, part of the fun of all of this stuff is how do you fit new things into old bottles, into existing law. Yeah.
Just to clarify, the correct intellectual property laws placed in the United States and in Europe, you cannot have patents on human organism. The definition of human organism has not been specifically defined. So you can, you know, patent a certain gene sequence, but human organism, the social Western term, is not defined.
But the question is, can you get a patent on one on a new human gene?
On a new, yeah, the gene you can. But then again, when it gets to human organism.
But the organism isn't patented. It's just that the organism is patented. The organism is a defendant. Right. Go back a step, just because it was in my notes and it shouldn't take very long. As you go through these different levels of how you do it, you also raise different sorts of moral problems. So if we think, let's go back to the selecting out your own children. A lot of people are going to be, most people, in fact, in our society, are going to be uncomfortable with selective infanticide. Anybody here willing to come out in favor of selective infanticide?
Well,
good for you.
Well, that's kind of what my paper is going to be on this view.
You're going to do it at the abortion level. I want to take the oldest and simplest level, where you produce the baby and then decide whether to let it live.
It's easy to make a case for suffering.
That's right.
It's like we do it for elderly people who are.
Because the elderly people get to decide for themselves. What I believe used to be very common, and if it's very common now, I think it's done very covertly, is that a child is born who has some very severe birth defect.
Yeah.
And the parents are told that the child did not survive birth. And what it's perfectly true, but the reason it didn't survive birth was that the physician in some way or other killed it.
Or I think there'd also be a case of, like, I don't know how it works with Siamese twins, where in some cases, if both
one of them has to die,
one of them has to die
yes.
as well. So you could imagine a scenario
yes.
that would play out.
That's, yes, and that one I think is done openly in the sense that you will have cases where only one twin can be saved. But it seems to me I don't know whether I'm in favor of it. Certainly, it's defensible to say if this child is going to have a miserable life and impose a great deal of misery on his parents, better it should not live. So I don't think infanticide is indefensible, it's just nobody's willing to defend it. That I like to raise the issue in the context of abortion, because infanticide, I think, is a wonderful point to raise in the abortion controversies, because it's a way of getting one side to understand the other side's position. That basically, one of the things that's irritating about the abortion controversy is that people on both sides are so sure that the other side's position is indefensible. And it seems to me, if you say to somebody who says, of course women should be have the right to control their bodies, so therefore abortion should be perfectly legal. And you say, well, one reason they should have a right to control their body, are there any other reasons? They say, well, yes, because there are going to be cases where having a child, being pregnant is a real pain, and having a child, all of those reasons. They say, well, that's very good. How about the woman who wishes to use the control of her body to let her newborn child starve to death? That after all, having to take care of the child is also a burden on your body. All of the arguments about how inconvenient it might be to bear a child also apply to how inconvenient it can be to bring a child up. So if you imagine a parent in a case where there aren't other people willing to take over the child, don't all of the arguments that say unquestionably abortion should be legal also imply that parents should have the right to abandon their children? And very, very few people are willing to accept that. And hopefully that gets them to see the other side's view, which is that it feels at gut level like murder, and people don't like murder. So, yes?
So there are four authors who just published the Criminal Medical Ethics, who argue just four of this, after birth abortion is allowable.
Yes.
And for even healthy, perfectly healthy.
What's their argument for the perfectly healthy ones?
I haven't read the whole thing, but the abstract basically is focusing on the thing that the sociological impact of those kids is in that way is
That's a more extreme case than I'm making, because the strongest case I'm willing to argue, and I don't think I believe in it, but I think it's at least defensible, is that the parents do not have an obligation to support the child, and that therefore no one else will take the child. But even that doesn't get you to deliberately killing the child if somebody else would take it, which presumably is what they're willing to defend. So that would be interesting to see.
They're pretty progressive. One guy's from Oxford Center of Ethics.
Yeah, well, first, if they're bioethicists, they aren't reputable. I disapprove of bioethicists on principle. But putting that aside, it's easy enough if you're, suppose you're a utilitarian. It's easy enough from utilitarian position, which says the objective is to maximize the total of human happiness, to say, well, if this particular child would reduce the happiness of other people by more than the value of the total happiness of his life, you ought to kill him. Of course, it applies to adults, too. That if you take seriously sort of the full-blown utilitarian position, you then have to abandon your intuitions about human rights. But it's harder from a rights-based perspective to defend that same position. But no, it's hard to think of very many propositions that a reasonably clever philosopher couldn't defend. But which is one reason why I try to base my political arguments on economics rather than philosophy, since I think we know more about it than philosophy. Philosophy is interesting, but not, I think, very productive. Let me mention a couple of other things. One of them is one which has actually been news stories on quite recently, and that's sort of interesting. And that's technologies to extend the woman's reproductive span. All right, we can extend the man's very easily. All you've got to do is to freeze sperm. And in principle, I guess you could extend the woman's by extracting eggs early and freezing them and then implanting them late. But there's apparently some new evidence suggesting that women, in fact, continue producing eggs after they're adults. That the standard of view used to be that by the time a female baby was born, all of the eggs were already in her. And I gather from the stuff I've read, there's now some evidence suggesting that's not true, and that there is some special kind of stem cell which can produce additional eggs. And then the idea is if we knew about that, we could extract a few of those stem cells from you at age 20, cryopreserve them, and then since it's only when you get to 45 that you decide that you want a baby, you now use those to produce an egg. At 45, you probably can still incubate a baby, probably, although you're more risky to produce one because your eggs have deteriorated, and so that would be a way in which women could have babies later. So that's not as radical an idea as these ones, but it still is sort of an interesting possible change in how our society works. Yeah?
I think I heard the same thing on NPR, and I thought that the counter argument to the technology was kind of persuasive, where there was a woman, obviously heavy on the woman's rights, who was arguing, what kind of society do we live in, where instead of providing accommodations to women that want to take maternity leave and, raise their children, that we just tell them that they can still get their career and then after the fact.
I'm not sure in what sense that's an answer to the technology. If the technology exists, it offers some options.
Yeah.
And there may be other options you'd like more.
But, it was just saying, if we feel strongly towards that option, the viable option, then...
But how about if we feel strongly towards the option that women should be allowed to make any decision they like as long as they're willing to bear the costs?
Yeah.
In that case, this technology... That person was saying women should be allowed to make to do something with somebody else paying for it. Maybe that's right. That depends on what you believe about people's rights. But a simpler claim, in a sense, is if they can do something that doesn't impose costs on other people, surely they should be allowed to do it. and this technology expands the range of things for which that's true.
What do you mean by it causes cost on other people?
If you say that if you want to have a baby, somebody else has to agree to give you leave even though he doesn't have a good replacement for you and doesn't want to, or if you want to have a baby, the state agrees to provide you some kind of a bonus, as in some European countries they do, to help pay for it, then someone else is bearing the cost. And that's not an indefensible position. My point is only that it is a less strong position, I think, than the claim that you should be allowed to do things that don't impose costs on other people. This is partly the distinction between what are sometimes called negative rights and positive rights. But your negative right is your right not to be interfered with. Your positive right is your right to get some outcome. You know?
Well, during the Industrial Revolution, did we have the same issue? What kind of society are we then? Instead of letting people go home and it's done, send them down, we make them work till 2 hours into the night. So then the state has to step in and you have to develop a work week and, 8 hour, 40 hour work weeks.
When you say had to.
Well, they did because we felt like, to counteract the technology that.
What do you mean we?
Well,
enough people were in favor of having a limited work week so that it passed. That tells us neither that everybody was in favor of it, nor whether it was a good or bad idea. Just the historical observation of what happened.
People wanted to, but then if you just... but it wasn't a strictly bottom line of a corporation that wanted it. They didn't see that fact so much.
I don't know what fact. From the standpoint of the corporation, presumably if people were willing to work an 8 hour day for the same hourly pay as a 12 hour day, as long as there were people available to hire, they wouldn't care very much. If people wanted to get the pay they had been getting for 12 hours in 8 hours, you could certainly understand the corporation would not be happy with that.
Well, right, but the thing is, the corporations, even maybe it's in the corporate long-term interest to support a policy in which
if that's the case, then those corporations that follow that policy will be more successful than those that don't.
But the thing is, the same argument Warren Buffett made about why don't I pay more taxes? Because why should I? Because
not the same. No, not at all. Because if a corporation says our employees, your employees work a 12-hour day, ours work a 10-hour day. We have discovered that our employees in 10 hours produce more than yours in 12 hours because ours are well rested. That's in the private, selfish interest of that corporation to do it. It doesn't require, it's not a case of I'm giving rest to your employees. Your employees are still tired because you're still working the 12 hours a day.
So in this context, you'd say that a corporation that has women, give adequate maternity leave, that it was beneficial.
Then some of them will do it, and after a while more of them will do it. But and I'm very likely some do. But if you're imposing it as a requirement, then the only ones you're going to affect in the long runs are the ones where from their standpoint it isn't beneficial. Putting it differently, you're saying that you're helping the workers by letting them only work 8 hours. The alternative is you've just cut the wages of the workers to 2/3 of what they were before. That after all, if you're wrong about if the shorter work week really makes them much more productive, then you don't really need the regulation, because then after a while firms will discover that. If it doesn't make them more productive, it's not like most of the revenue of a firm is going to profit, and not in at least any modern society I know of. So roughly speaking, when you say you can only work 8 hours instead of 12 hours, you're saying you can only earn 2/3 as much money as you were before. If you'd like that deal, you could probably have found a corporation willing to hire you for 8 hours for a lower pay. I, in fact, am a half-time professor at half pay, perfectly reasonable arrangement from my standpoint. So I think it's not as simple as you're making it out. But anyway, but that would be a long controversy. But in any case, going back to our reproductive stuff for a moment, what I was going to say is that if you just think about ways of selecting among your own children, that infanticide is morally troubling to practically everybody. Abortion of, a 3-month fetus is morally troubling to many people. I guess it's troubling to most people. It's just that some people say it's troubling, but the alternative is worse, and some people say the other way around. Aborting a 8-cell fetus is going to be troubling to some people who have sort of strong religious views. I suspect the Catholic Church disapproves. But many, many fewer people. Aborting almost all of your sperm is not troubling to anybody, because that's been happening all the time, right? A very small fraction of sperm end up producing babies. So in that sense, as you move down those technologies, from that moral standpoint, as far as I can tell, you're going from the more objectionable to the less objectionable. Now, there's still possibly other moral arguments, so that there are people who will say, I mean, I like to claim that the dominant religion of modern America is nature worship. And we don't call it that, but if you think about the fact that people treat saying this food is a natural food as if it was obviously a compliment, right? There aren't any natural foods other than sea salt, right? Essentially, virtually everything we eat is the product of many, many generations of selective breeding, all right? Some cases of cloning. After all, fruit trees have been cloned for 2,000 years, and grapevines. We call it grafting. That's a form of cloning. But there's this gut level feeling that natural means good. All right. What did people used to say about homosexuality? Oh, it's unnatural. Look at what I regard as the weirdest bit of the whole argument over global warming, is that both sides agree that one of the really critical questions is whether it's anthropogenic, whether people did it. Why do you care? All right, if global warming has bad consequences, it has bad consequences, whether it's because the sun has gotten hotter or because human beings pump out CO2. And, you know, whether humans caused it might give you a suggestion of how to stop it, but you could imagine other ways of stopping it. It's not really the central issue. And yet everybody acts as if it did. And I think there's a gut-level feeling that somehow, if the sun is doing it to us, it's all right. That's natural. If we're doing it to ourselves, that's bad. All right. So it's really a weird attitude. I was just working on a blog post. I haven't finished yet on this subject. But it does seem to me that there's sort of a religious gut-level feeling in our culture about natural being good. And so from that standpoint, you could certainly imagine people who said, even Heinlein's version, in which we're not killing anything except sperm and eggs that are going to, almost all of which will die anyway, even in that version, it's wrong. Because human beings are taking control of something that should be left either to God if you're religious or to nature if you're the other religion, so to speak. So that would be a further possible moral one. I find it very unconvincing, obviously. That doesn't mean that everybody will. Let me say a little bit about the implications of the technology that we already have pretty fully implemented, which is contraception. Because one of the really weird features for those of us who are old enough to remember when this was a controversy is that a major argument at the time in favor of both contraception and abortion being legal and reasonably readily available was to reduce the number of, quote, unwanted children. And in that argument, it was assumed that the child of an unmarried mother was an unwanted child. All right? So if you go back to about the time when Roe versus Wade or when Griswold were happening, the people who were saying, yes, this is the way we ought to move, I think would have said without any question, and if we move that way, the number of children born to unmarried mothers will steeply decline. We moved that way, and the number of children born to unmarried mothers steeply increased. That's an interesting puzzle. All right, it's not clearly an insoluble puzzle. There's a, I think, fairly convincing economic argument, which basically says, in a society which doesn't have reliable contraception, I'm going to include abortion, it doesn't really matter for these purposes, sex and pregnancy are joint products. Having sex means a chance of having pregnancy. Given that lots of women would like to have children but would not like to raise a child by themselves, that means that women are reluctant to have sex except with men who either are married to them or will commit to marrying them if they get pregnant, which is actually quite a common traditional institution. There's some evidence that end of the 19th century in a number of cities for which people have looked at the data, something like a third or a quarter of brides were pregnant. All you have to do is look at birth date versus marriage date. People have done that. It's sort of interesting. So in that society, men who want sex are going to have a hard time to get it unless they're willing to commit to support. Now you move to a world where contraception and abortion are readily available. Women who don't want children but who like men like sex are perfectly willing to have sex with men without any such commitment. Their competition, means that the women who want both sex and babies can, in effect, make the price of the sex being the willingness to support the babies, and so some of them choose to have babies without having husbands. That's basically the Akerlof and Yellen story put in a different language than they put it. I'm not sure it's right, but it is certainly a striking change in exactly the opposite of the predicted direction, and it provides one possible explanation of it. And of course, I should say, I'm a little skeptical, going back to the beginning of that story, of the assumption everybody was making then that children of unmarried mothers were unwanted children. All right, the implicit assumption was that that was all contraceptive failure, that those that all of those women would only have chosen to have a child if they had a husband, because after all, you wouldn't have chosen to have a child if you didn't have a husband. And I suspect that it isn't true, that there were some women who were in circumstances where they either couldn't get a husband or couldn't get a husband they would want to live with, really wanted to have their own baby, and therefore chose to get pregnant anyway. But that wasn't the assumption that went into the arguments being made, at least as far as I can remember being made at the time. It was sort of a... The other things relevant to some of this. I was going to mention that I discovered today that my two seminars have collided. My legal system is very different than this one. Over the issue of gender ambiguity, that we are used to taking it for granted that everybody is either male or female. Very, very useful thing to take for granted. It simplifies a whole lot of things. You only need two restrooms, for example, and one for men and one for women, and we can have laws that determine on men and women and a whole bunch of other stuff. It isn't true. It has never been true. It's only almost true. All right? There have always been occasional hermaphrodites, people who physically had some of the some male and some female genitals, or effectively both to some degree. There have, although we didn't know until very recently, always been people who were neither XX nor XY genetically. That there are a number of others. XXY is apparently something like 1 in 1,000 apparent males. So that's actually the most common. But there are a bunch of other genetic abnormalities which don't fit neatly into this. In addition, there is now reason to suspect that there are some people who are biologically one gender and psychologically another, and those are the people who want to have sex change operations. So that means that we've gone from this nice, neat, tidy system to a situation, well, that system works pretty well, but here are a bunch of cases that don't fit. And how do you adapt your law and your customs? If you are in one of the unclear cases, do you get to go to the men's room or the ladies' room? If you are somebody who thinks you're female but physically is male, do the other women get to object to your going into the ladies' room? You can think of a whole bunch of issues. We have men's and women's prisons. We have men's and women's sports. All right, and there have been real controversies over women athletes who people suspected weren't exactly women. And maybe weren't. Maybe they didn't even know they weren't. Maybe they were people who had female genitals but were XY genetically, because occasionally you get a mismatch between genotype and phenotype, because various things in various characteristics in the womb determine whether you end up with male or female genitals, and apparently there are bizarre situations in which you get the wrong one in terms of your own genotype. So, turns out that these issues were covered in Jewish law 2,000 years ago. Not all of them, they didn't know about the genetics. But the Jewish law, traditional Jewish law, has two categories other than male and female. One of them is hermaphrodite, and the other is something called a tum-tum, which apparently is somebody who, as born, did not have visible genitals. And it's not clear what kind of an abnormality this is, but if you look at the references, it sounds as though, rather than being a hermaphrodite, this is somebody who, with surgery, you might... like maybe they had skin growing over part of their groin or something, I'm not sure, but there are references to, you know, that when they're opened up surgically, you discover it's male or discover it's female. And so Jewish law had to deal with how you fit these people into the legal system. And I was just reading, it's still an issue. I found it on the web, and there was something by someone who I assume is a rabbi or an expert, and he was saying, well, this scholar says that in the case of a hermaphrodite, it is doubtful whether the hermaphrodite is male or female. Jewish law imposes certain religious obligations on males and certain religious obligations on females. And since we don't know which this person is, he's got to do all of them. Has to follow the stricter rule. But other scholars say, no, all the hermaphrodites are really male, so they follow the male rules. And I forget what some of the other scholars. But I thought it was really neat discovering that, as far as I know, this issue is not covered in traditional Anglo-American law. Am I right? That there isn't a non-male-female category. Maybe there is by now, because I don't know how we handle transgendered people nowadays. But certainly there isn't traditionally. And yet, a version of it, two versions of it, were being covered in traditional law. And in the modern version, you have the question of what's the application of halakhic of law to questions such as surgically correcting cases. Because, of course, the most common response to discovering that a baby appears to have both male and female genitals is to surgically remove one of them in order that the child can grow up believing himself, herself, to be a normal male-female. And it's not clear that's the right answer, especially if it turns out that psychologically you're committed to one side and you might end up with the body of the other side. But that is, I think, the most common one. And apparently there's real question in Jewish law as to whether you're allowed to do that for various reasons. This thing goes into it. So, anyway, I thought it was sort of neat that the two seminars would run into each other at that point. All right, have a nice vacation. Enjoy yourself. I'm going to spend a day or so of it in New York. I'm giving a talk at Columbia on something or other. Yeah, I'll have to look up what I'm talking about. Before I get there.
Hi. I'm submitting issues for this, so do I need to get
submitting what?
Issues for this topic?
Right.
Do I need to get them to you by this Saturday or the Saturday class starts?
The answer is that you have to get them on Saturday when the class starts, but since only four people are supposed to count for issues on each topic, if I get issues for, I've got three already, so if I get issues for something, oh, you're all good, there's no problem.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
It was only if you have to sign up.
Yeah.
As long as you're signed up, you're all right. Fine.
So I can get it to you
by the Saturday before. By preference, before midnight, so I don't have to stay up before I get it. But midnight is the absolute.
I could ask another question.
Yes. I'm